So our presentation today, Zealot, the Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, is going to be presented by Alan Knox, who's one of our own. In our fellowship, not only do we, as members, lead the services, but at least a third of the time, our own members present. And today, Alan Knox is going to be presenting. Now, Jane and Alan Knox joined the Unitarian Fellowship of Regina in the mid-1990s to give their children, Alyssa and Trevor, an exposure to religious education. Over the years, Alan has served on many committees and a term or two as president. In July of 1987, Alan left the world of work to become the at-home parent to daughter Alyssa. Trevor followed 3 years later, and Alan's planned hiatus became a new career. Prior to becoming Mr. Mom, Alan worked for the Saskatoon YMCA as director of the youth department and YMCA Camp Wakanda, for Hamilton Burlington YMCA as director of the camping branch and director of YMCA Camp Wanakita, for Grand Prairie Regional College in Alberta as chairman of the Department of Community Services, and finally, for the Saskatchewan Parks and Recreation Association as recreation consultant. In the midst of these placements, Alan taught 7 courses as a sessional lecturer while attending graduate school at the University of Saskatchewan in the mid-1970s. It was during this time that he met and courted Jane, who was teaching in the Faculty of Nursing at the time. They met in October and were married at the end of March the following year. So Alan is about to give us this presentation, Zealot, the Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth.
Thank you, Sandra. Let's get rid of that, or we'll try, but it's going to be obnoxious. And I don't know where to put this here. Try that. This is the book, and it is a fascinating book. I think you might enjoy some of the information. Leo Tolstoy said, "History would be a wonderful thing if it were only true." It's difficult to know, you know, anything being accurate when you're going back so many years. So I saw that quote recently, and I thought that fit perfectly with what we're going to talk about today. Need a little bit of a side place here for presenters so they can spread their materials out a little bit. We should give that some thought. Now, why is this of interest? I'd like to read this paragraph from a promotion for a new great course called The Greatest Controversies of Early Christian History by Professor Bart D. Ehrman. "Christianity has arguably been the most important force in the history of Western civilization. Whether we view it in religious, social, political, or economic terms, Christianity has deeply and integrally influenced the Western worldview and way of life, as well as our most basic notions of selfhood, morality, and ethics. Without the presence and role of Christianity, our world would be considerably different. As such, understanding Christianity is fundamental to understanding our civilization, our culture, and our origins." Just a word about the text. As you see, it's a very, it's a good book. And at the back are 53 pages of notes in smaller print. So a lot of very good information there, and we're only going to cover about two-thirds of the content today because of lack of time. And a small mention about Josephus. Some of you may know that name, others may not. But he was a Roman general who surrendered to the Romans during the war. the Jewish War, and eventually became a Roman citizen. He was a historian and wrote two books, one called The Jewish War and one called Antiquities. And in Antiquities, there is a very small, oblique reference to Jesus being the brother of James and also called the Messiah. So that's historically, in outside of the Bible, that's almost all we know about Jesus. And I will quote from him a couple of times just so that you know who he is. Now, Reza Aslan is an internationally acclaimed writer and scholar of religions. His book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, is the result of 2 decades of rigorous academic research into the origins of Christianity. He is the author of such books as No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, and How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror, which has been published in paperback as Beyond Fundamentalism. And I want to give you an abridged timeline or chronology, about two-thirds of the chronology that he gives in the book itself, just to give you an idea of what's happening in Palestine at this period of time. BCE stands for Before the Common Era, and CE now means the Common Era, as opposed to BC and AD. So if it's a BCE, I will give that designation, but if it's in the Common Era, I'll just give you the year. In 164 BCE, the Maccabean Revolt occurred. 37, Herod the Great was named King of the Jews. In 4 BCE, Herod the Great died, and also the revolt of Judas the Galilean occurred. It seems that it's estimated that Jesus was of Nazareth was born somewhere between 4 BCE and 6 of the Common Era. 26, Pontius Pilate becomes governor in Jerusalem. 26-28, launch of John the Baptist's ministry. 28-30, launch of Jesus of Nazareth's ministry. 30-33, death of Jesus of Nazareth. 36, revolt of the Samaritan. 37, conversion of Paul of Tarsus, who became Paul. 44, revolt of Thutis. 46, revolt of Jacob and Simon, the sons of Judas the Galilean. 57, revolt of the Egyptian. 62, death of James, the brother of Jesus. 66, the death of Paul and the Apostle Peter in Rome. 66, the Jewish revolt. Actually, it was from 64 to 66. And the year 70, the destruction of Jerusalem when the Romans returned. And 70-71, the Gospel of Mark was written. 73, Rome, the Romans capture Masada. And Jane and I have been to Masada. 80-90, the Epistle of James was written. 90-100, the Gospels of Matthew and Luke were written. 100-120, the Gospel of John. 132, revolt of Simon, son of Cocpa. 313, Emperor Constantine issues the Edict of Milan. 325, the Council of Nicaea, where the bishops at that time were asked to determine what is the theology of Christianity. They were commissioned by Constantine. And in 398, the Council of Hippo Regius occurred, where the books of the New Testament were determined, and many of the books that were not selected were simply destroyed. So we don't have some counter views. But fortunately, I think around 1947, in Egypt at Nag Hammadi, there were a whole new, well, the Dead Sea Scrolls also were found in Israel, but in Nag Hammadi in Egypt, the Gnostic Gospels were found. And so we have a lot of additional information now about these times and the person we know as Jesus from those writings. But of course, it's led to a lot of confusion. Oops. So, to start. In his author's note at the beginning of the text, Aslan states, quote, "When I was 15 years old, I found Jesus. I spent the summer of my sophomore year at an evangelical youth camp in Northern California. It was there that I heard a remarkable story that would change my life forever. And then he highlights the Christian story. Aslan then reflects on his being born and raised in Iran, quote, in a motley family of lukewarm Muslims and exuberant atheists. His awakening interest in religion led Aslan to study the Bible. Quote, the more I probed the Bible to arm myself against the doubts of unbelievers, the more distance I discovered between the Jesus of the Gospels and the Jesus of history, between Jesus the Christ and Jesus of Nazareth. This study led to his own doubts. And I quote, the bedrock of evangelical Christianity, at least it was taught to me, is the unconditional belief that every word of the Bible is God-breathed and true, literal, and inerrant. The sudden realization that this belief is patently and irrefutably false, that the Bible is replete with the most blatant and obvious errors and contradictions, just as one would expect from a document written by hundreds of hands across thousands of years, left me confused and spiritually unmoored. And so, like many people in my situation, I angrily discarded my faith as if it were a costly forgery I had been duped into buying. I began to rethink the faith and culture of my forefathers, finding in them as an adult a deeper, more intimate familiarity than I ever had as a child, the kind that comes from reconnecting with an old friend after many years apart. From the introduction, quote, it is a miracle that we know anything at all about the man called Jesus of Nazareth, the itinerant preacher wandering from village to village, clamoring about the end of the world. A band of ragged followers trailing behind was a common sight in Jesus' time, so common in fact that it had become a kind of caricature among the Roman elite. Quote, countless prophets, preachers, and messiahs tramped through the Holy Land, delivering the message of God's imminent judgment. Many of these so-called false messiahs we know by name. The prophet Thutis, a charismatic figure known only as the Egyptian. Athrongus in 4 BCE, the Samaritan, Hezekiah the bandit chief, Simon of Pariah, Judas the Galilean, his grandson Menahem, Simon son of Giora, and Simon son of Kokhba. You can add to this list the Essene sect and the first century Jewish revolutionary party known as the Zealots, who helped launch the bloody war against Rome in the year 64. The Zealot Party was established about 30 years after Jesus' death, so in the early 60s. And the fearsome bandit assassins whom the Romans dubbed the Sicarii, the daggermen. In the midst of this messianic energy walked Jesus of Nazareth, quote, a man of profound contradictions, one day preaching a message of racial exclusion, the next of benevolent universalism, sometimes promoting violence and conflict. The problem of pinning down the historical Jesus is that outside of the New Testament there is almost no trace of the man who would so permanently alter the course of human history, which is fascinating. This is one of the reasons that I, an atheist, am interested in the study of Christianity. It is a mystery worth solving by historians. If there was such a man, what did he really say? What was his message? How did it become so distorted over time that if he were to return, he would not only be amazed, but extremely disappointed? Clearly, he would not recognize Christianity as being any part of him. We are left, therefore, with whatever information can be gleaned from the New Testament. The first writings that mention Jesus are the letters that Paul sent to his congregations around the Mediterranean, composed between the years 48 and 50, 2 decades after Jesus' death. Not all the letters attributed to Paul were actually written by him, but several are thought to be authentic. These are mentioned in the text. Aslan comments that while Paul's writing may be helpful in understanding how Christianity became formed, they are not very helpful for uncovering the historical Jesus. This leaves us with the Gospels, with all their inaccuracies and contradictions. With the exception of the Gospel of Luke, which along with the book of Acts may have been written by a man named Luke, we don't know who wrote the other three Gospels, Mark, Matthew, John. This literary device was common in the ancient world, Actually, the Gospels were never intended to be historical documents of Jesus' life. Quote, they are testimonies of faith composed by communities of faith and written many years after the events they describe. Simply put, the Gospels tell us about Jesus the Christ, not Jesus the man. Mark's Gospel was written about the year 70, after the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. It is likely based on a collection of oral and perhaps a handful of written traditions that had been passed around by Jesus' earliest followers for years. Another source for the Gospels, composed about the year 50, was a presumed collection of Jesus' sayings that scholars have termed Q, from the German quell or source. In the end, what can we really say about Jesus of Nazareth? That he was a Jew who led a popular Jewish movement in Palestine at the beginning of the first century of the Common Era, and that he was crucified by Rome for doing so. Yet what we know about the times in which Jesus lived can help us paint a picture of the man. Quote, a zealous revolutionary, swept up as all Jews of the era were, in the religious and political turmoil of first century Palestine. Simply, Jesus was a revolutionary who was crucified by the Romans for sedition, his crime striving for kingly rule. This is why the plaque or titulus placed on his cross said, King of the Jews. It was not meant to be sarcasm, just a declaration of what his crime was. All those crucified had such a plaque. It is important to realize that almost every gospel story written about the life and mission of Jesus of Nazareth was composed after the Jewish rebellion against Rome in the years 64 to 66. To appeal to Gentiles living in the Roman world, quote, the gospel writers sought to temper the revolutionary nature of Jesus' message and movement. In the year 70, the Romans returned and destroyed Jerusalem. Josephus wrote, so complete was the destruction wrought upon the holy city, there was nothing left to prove Jerusalem had ever been inhabited. And another quote. Exiled from the land promised them by God, forced to live as outcasts among the pagans of the Roman Empire, the rabbis of the second century gradually and deliberately divorced Judaism from the radical messianic nationalism that had launched the ill-fated war with Rome. The Torah replaced the temple in the center of Jewish life, and rabbinic Judaism emerged. The Christians, too, felt the need to distance themselves from the revolutionary zeal that had led to the sacking of Jerusalem, not only because it allowed the early church to ward off the wrath of a deeply revengeful Rome, but also because with the Jewish religion having become pariah, the Romans had become the primary target of the church's evangelism. Thus began the long process of transforming Jesus from a revolutionary Jewish nationalist into a peaceful spiritual leader with no interest in any earthly matter. That was a Jesus the Romans could accept, and in fact did accept 3 centuries later, when the Roman Emperor Flavius Theodosius made the itinerant Jewish preachers movement the official religion of the state, and what we now recognize as Orthodox Christianity was born. Was Jesus of Nazareth the Messiah, the quote-unquote anointed one? This refers to the practice of pouring or smearing oil, and I assume holy oil, on someone charged with divine office, a king, a priest, or a prophet. Quote, the principal task of the Messiah, who was popularly believed to be the descendant of King David, was to rebuild David's kingdom and reestablish the nation of Israel. Thus, to call oneself the Messiah at the time of the Roman occupation was tantamount to declaring war on Rome. Let us go back to the beginning. Nazareth was a simple hilltop village about a day's walk from the metropolis of Sepphoris. About 100 families lived there. There are no roads, no public buildings, no synagogue. The villagers share a simple well. It is, quote, a village of mostly illiterate peasants, farmers, and day laborers, a place that does not exist on any map. So identified was Jesus of Nazareth that he was known throughout his life simply as the Nazarene. Only Matthew and Luke make reference to Jesus being born in Bethlehem. This is done to provide a link to King David, as Bethlehem was his city. Bethlehem is not mentioned anywhere else in the New Testament. The gospel writers were more concerned with uncovering quote-unquote everlasting truths than they were of being historically accurate. As Jesus begins his ministry about the year 28, some of his followers begin to refer to him as the Messiah. Aslan discusses the varying views about the meaning of the Messiah, but the problem for the gospel writers is that, quote, there is simply no single, cohesive prophetic narrative concerning the Messiah in the Hebrew Scriptures, unquote. It would appear the consensus at this point in time was that the Messiah was supposed to be a descendant of King David who, quote, comes to restore Israel, to free the Jews from the yoke of occupation, and to establish God's rule in Jerusalem. Obviously, Jesus and all the other declared messiahs failed in these tasks. Somewhat facetiously, we might say God was not of much help. Today's Jews, of course, must still be waiting for the real Messiah. Coming from Nazareth, Jesus would likely have been an illiterate day laborer. It is estimated that the Jewish peasantry at this time would have been 97% illiterate. He spoke Aramaic, not Hebrew. He would have been part of a large family. At least four brothers are named in the Gospels. The story of the virgin birth may have been invented to mask the likelihood Jesus was illegitimate. A scriptural reference to the book of Isaiah is often given, though the Hebrew word used is Alma, which simply means a young girl. A different word entirely would have been used to describe a virgin. Jesus was likely married. There was no mention of this in the New Testament. There is some speculation that his wife was Mary Magdalene. He would likely have found work as a day laborer in Sepphoris, a day's walk from Nazareth. When Herod died in 4 BCE, his building program ended, leaving many peasants and day laborers out of work. The countryside again became, quote, a hotbed of revolutionary activity. A new group of bandits led by Judas the Galilean arose. He may have been the son of the famed bandit chief Hezekiah, a failed messiah who Herod had beheaded. Actually, the term Galilean had become synonymous with the word rebel. And remember, Nazareth is in the Galilee. Judas joined forces with a mysterious Pharisee named Zadok to launch a new independence movement that Josephus termed the Fourth Philosophy, as opposed to the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. The members of this movement were committed to freeing Israel from foreign rule, and their, quote, fervent insistence even unto death that they would serve no Lord save the one God. This zeal implied a, quote, strict adherence to the Torah and the law, a refusal to serve any foreign master, to serve any human master at all, and an uncompromising devotion to the sovereignty of God, unquote. Their attitude was to be zealous for the Lord. Some zealots were willing to resort to violence to oppose Rome and their fellow citizens who dared to submit to Rome. During Jesus' lifetime, such a zealotry was, quote, an idea, an aspiration, a model of piety inextricably linked to the widespread sense of apocalyptic expectation that had seized the Jews in the wake of the Roman occupation. Quote, there was a feeling that the present order was coming to an end, that a new and divinely inspired order was about to reveal itself. The kingdom of God was at hand. Everyone was talking about it, but God's reign could only be ushered in by those with the zeal to fight for it. Armed with this zeal as his weapon, Jesus finally takes his message to Jerusalem. Let us turn now to Pontius Pilate. He arrived in Jerusalem in the year 26 and served till the year 36. He was not, as portrayed in the Gospels. He was, in fact, a ruthless governor responsible for sending thousands of Jews to the cross. He conspired with the high priest Caiaphas to keep a lid on the revolutionary impulse of the Jews. They dealt, quote, ruthlessly with any hint of political disturbance, no matter how small. In the year 36, Pilate was summoned to Rome to explain his ruthless actions. He never returned. He was exiled to Gaul, a series of basically incompetent governors followed Pilate, which only served to make matters much worse in Palestine. Joseph Caiaphas was dismissed from his position as high priest in the year 36 as well. Quote, with Pilate and Caiaphas gone, there was no longer any hope of stifling the revolutionary passion of the Jews. By mid-century, the whole of Palestine was buzzing with messianic energy. The revolutionary leader Thutis was beheaded in the year 44. Jacob and Simon, two sons of Judas the Galilean, were crucified in the year 46. The bandit chief Eleazar, son of Dinias, was crucified. Jesus, son of Ananias, is mentioned, but not his fate. The Egyptians' followers were massacred, but he apparently escaped. In the year 56, a Sicarii assassin killed Jonathan, the high priest. The Sicarii assassins began attacking the members of the Jewish ruling class. Josephus wrote, more terrible than their crimes was the fear they aroused, every man hourly expecting death, as in war. In the year 64, a full-scale revolt against Rome was launched. By the year 66, the Zealot Party took control of Jerusalem. In the year 70, the Romans returned and destroyed Jerusalem. In the year 73, the last 1,000 Jewish rebels at Masada chose to kill themselves rather than be captured or killed by the Romans. At least legend tells us so. Judaism was in a sense banned. The surviving Jews were expelled from Palestine. The surviving Jews blamed the rebels, the Zealots and the Sicarii, who had preached independence from Rome. They began to distance themselves from this revolutionary idealism. The messianic fervor, however, survived somewhat and led to a brief second Jewish war against Rome in the year 132. This one led by the Messiah known as Simon, son of Kokhba. For the most part, however, the rabbis of the second century developed an anti-nationalistic interpretation of Judaism. The study of the law, the Torah, took the place of temple sacrifices in the life of the observant Jew. At this time also, tradition says a Jew named John Mark composed the first gospel written about the Messiah known as Jesus of Nazareth, not in Hebrew nor in Aramaic, but in Greek, the language of the heathens and victors. And language is very important, and we have to go into that some other time. Aslan says this is the beginning of the good news of Jesus the Christ. Aslan then returns to Jesus entering Jerusalem and cleansing the temple. He describes this as political theater designed to imply the fulfillment of prophecy. It is, however, in the eyes of the Romans and the temple priests, an act of sedition. It leads to Jesus' crucifixion. Aslan does not discuss that given the times and the practices of the Romans, this result should have been expected, which leaves open the question, did Jesus really intend to die on a cross? Was this his plan all along? And did he expect this would precipitate a rebellion? Unfortunately, we do not have enough time to discuss all of the material Aslan discusses in his book, especially how Jesus' message became distorted and Christianity emerged as a new religion. Aslan discusses who was John the Baptist. What was his significance? What was the purpose of baptism? What was meant by the terms kingdom of God, kingdom of heaven, the Son of Man? Aslan describes Jesus' ministry, his focus on the rural peasantry. We are introduced to his chief followers, 72 of them, and the 12 who would serve a special function in his ministry, each one to represent one of the 12 tribes of Israel. They become the principal bearers of Jesus' message, his chief missionaries. What was his message? Was Jesus the Messiah? What was the messianic secret? Jesus does not say he is the Messiah, but he implies that he is the Messiah. No doubt he is aware that to declare himself the Messiah is to make himself open to the charge of sedition. And a few words about the aftermath. The year 70, the temple is in ruins, the Jewish religion is made pariah. What were Jesus' followers to do? Continue the struggle against foreign rule or, quote, divorce themselves from Judaism and transform their Messiah from a fierce Jewish nationalist into a pacific preacher of good works whose kingdom was not of this world. As the Jews were dispersed, quote, the center of the Christian movement shifted from Jewish Jerusalem to the Greco-Roman cities of the Mediterranean. Quote, by the end of the first century, when the bulk of the Gospels were being written, Rome, in particular the Roman intellectual elite, had become the primary target of Christian evangelism. For this to succeed, all traces of the revolutionary zeal had to be removed from the life of Jesus. The Romans had to be absolved of any responsibility for Jesus' death. It was the Jewish priests who insisted Pilate condemn and crucify Jesus. Quote, thus a story concocted by Mark strictly for evangelistic purposes to shift the blame for Jesus' death away from Rome is stretched with the passage of time to the point of absurdity, becoming in the process the basis for 2,000 years of Christian anti-Semitism. Aslan also discusses the resurrection. Yet a belief in a dying and rising Messiah simply did not exist in Judaism. There are no such references anywhere in the Hebrew Bible. He describes how Jesus becomes to be seen as God made flesh, but the presumption of a God-man was simply anathema in Judaism. Jesus of Nazareth fades away. Jesus becomes the Christ, and Christianity is born. The final third of the book chronicles how Jesus' followers, led by his brother James the Just, lose out to the influence of Paul and his invention of the Christ. It is a fascinating story, and there is much to tell, but perhaps on another day. If you would like to hear the rest of the story, let Helen know, and I'll prepare part two. Now, as it turns out, just having received a missive from Aslan's website, where did I put that? Tomorrow at 3:30 our time, if you're interested, you will be able to participate in a dialogue with him. I have it here somewhere. But if you see me later and if you're interested, I can give you the web address for that. And you might want to take part in that. Oh, it's got to be here somewhere. Sorry about that. So, that's it. Oh, here we go. Called Live Online Chat with Dr. Reza Aslan, author of Zealot, and give the time, and there's a web address that you can sort of dial into and participate in that discussion or listen to it or maybe even ask questions using something on Twitter if you're into Twitter. But anyway, thank you for your attention. I don't know if you have any questions. I'm not sure I would have any answers because that's not my information. It's Aslan's. But I might be able to add something that that you're puzzled about from my memory.
Yeah, just the mic. I don't know if it's... Yeah, it's on. We're running a little late today, so we'll take three questions and just leave it at that. So, here we go.
I'm just interested in what kind of record keeping when you go back to the Old Testament, and were they still just using papyrus and quill pens, and where were these records stored, and how did they put them all together? I just wondered if you could...
No, I can't offer much there, although over the years I've sort of read about that, but my memory would fail me. I think much of the Old Testament was put together actually in the years in the sort of 900 BCE, that area, that era. And obviously most of the people there were illiterate, so it would, you know, it would be the priests who would be preaching and the people would be listening, and because they had no way of reading texts themselves, even at this time they did not have that.
Hi, Al. It's Ingrid here. I just wanted to make a comment more than... I think you said that the story in the Bible about Jesus going into the temple and turning the tables upside down with the, trying to stop the moneymakers. I just found that... Is that actually part of the sort of historical reference that it actually happened, or is that something that you think was a good story?
Well, it's in the New Testament, but we don't know if it happened or not.
Okay.
You see, again, in all of these other people that I mentioned, all of these other false messiahs are at least mentioned in the historical record. Jesus is not.
Okay. I just wanted to make the comment, though, that if you think about it, the rebels, every time if they focus on the rich, are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple questions. First is maybe what drew you to this book? And then secondly, do you see a sanitization of other possible messiahs in our age, such as Gandhi or Martin Luther King, in that they were really working against power elites, but later the power elites almost take the positive of those and leave the things that hurt them to decide. I don't know if you kind of see what I'm talking about.
Sort of. But in a sense, we know so much about those people because they're current, and we know the context and the background, and they weren't, in a sense, trying to be something. You know, who was the Messiah? What was a Messiah? And that sort of thing. So I don't think so. Yeah. Maybe Susan had a question, if we could do ask that.
Does the book mention in any way whatsoever why it was that this man, Jesus, became the focus rather than some of the other rebels who were so much better known? Why was he the one that became the focus of the religion?
That we'll have to do in part two, because it is fairly extensive as to Paul, you see, moved into the Mediterranean and was converting people to his vision of the Christ, whereas Jesus' followers were still in Jerusalem trying to spread the message of Jesus the man. And on two occasions, actually, Paul had to come back to the council and be admonished for doing what he was doing, because to them he was preaching the wrong thing, because they were Jews and Paul was preaching to Gentiles, realizing that he couldn't convert them all to Judaism or become Jews. And that is a very complex but very fascinating process. And then again, you see, during the Jewish war, when Jerusalem was destroyed and all of the Jews were dispersed, Jesus' direct followers, his family, friends, and immediate followers were either killed or dispersed themselves. So their momentum was lost, and Paul, who was already out in the diaspora, was the one who was left to proclaim his message. He rarely, if anything, he rarely at all spoke about Jesus the man. It was always Jesus the Christ. And you sort of know what that is.
Thank you very much.
Maybe we could talk more downstairs.
Yeah, there are quite a few more questions, but our time has really passed. So thank you so much for exploring this historical background. We have readings, Christian readings and so forth in our book.